So next we have our, I was going to say our local keynote speaker, but Greg isn't located in San Francisco. He's actually located in the Kansas City regional office. If you look at his bio on the ICE website, it's his old one not reflecting our organizational change. So Captain Greg Dill is actually the OPAL Deputy Director of Innovation and Financial Management, which I think I mentioned earlier. He's an active duty commissioned corps officer assigned to CMS, and he leads the administration of the Medicare fee-for-service program at the regional level to protect over 57 million beneficiaries, inform over 1.6 million healthcare providers, physicians, and practitioners, and ensure the Medicare program's fiscal integrity. Greg has more than 20 years of experience in the healthcare industry. Prior to joining CMS, Greg worked at the Department of Defense, Food and Drug Administration, and in the private sector. He transferred his commission from the U.S. Army to the U.S. Public Health Service in 2003 and has served HHS in various public health roles and deployments. Greg holds a Doctor of Pharmacy degree from the University of Illinois and a Master's of Public Health degree from the California College for Health Sciences. Please welcome Captain Greg Dill.
Thank you.
Well, good morning. Oh, it is working good. It's a pleasure and privilege to be invited back to this forum. Actually, I was just telling Ann backstage, I only get to wear this jacket maybe two or three times a year. And so I'm always happy when I put it on and it still fits. So I put it on today and I'm like, oh, it's going to be a good day. I don't have to let my buttons out. So, well, again, it's nice to be back and give you an update. As the slide indicates, I'm going to talk about innovation. Specifically, I really want to dig into what CMS is doing to drive healthcare transformation here in the United States. That's a huge task. Last year, I talked about technology, but this year I want to talk about innovation. And I'll do it in the same format that I've done it in the past couple years. We'll talk about the challenges, right? What are the things we're trying to solve for? For this audience, it'll be more of an update because you've seen some of this before, but I'll show you where we were last year with some of those challenges and where we are this year. Then I'll talk about strategy. And what I've done is I've really gone through all the CMS guidance documents in the last quarter, and I want to bring you the most current perspective on how the administration and the agency, the administrator, is looking to, again, transform healthcare in the United States. And then at the end, I'll really talk about a few examples, both in the fee-for-service program and with our models, some of which you are helping us with, talking about how those attributes of change are baked into those. So that's what I hope to do in the next 45 minutes or so. This is my disclaimer. I have nothing to claim, although now I have two children in college, so I might publish a GoFundMe account, and we'll see if that gets me in trouble. So if I can get this to move. Okay, so you're probably looking at this wondering, what am I looking at a picture of? As you heard in the bio and you've heard in years past, I manage a little over 200 people, 60 of which are financial management staff, and the majority of them are accountants. And about a decade ago, one of those accountants got me to read the CMS financial report. It comes out every November with absolutely no fanfare, but it is the most interesting document because where the money goes is really where a lot of attention goes. And so this year, again, just about 3 weeks ago, it came out. And the cover kind of blew me away. So if you look at the 2009 version, this is what they always look like. You know, they've got Lincoln in the background, and he's reliable and honest, and you believe our financial report, right? So we've always picked something like that. Then this year, this graphic came out, and it just really, it grabbed my attention. You know, probably not a lot of avid readers of the financial report. But notice the very top. It says, transforming the healthcare system through competition and innovation. Let me read that again. Transforming the healthcare system through competition and innovation. That is absolutely what we are doing at CMS. We recognize as the largest payer in the country, actually in the world, a lot of responsibility rests on our shoulder, And our administrator and the administration said, we are going to transform not just CMS, not just Medicare, Medicaid, Marketplace, but we're going to transform the entire healthcare system. How are we going to do that? Competition and innovation. And that's what I want to talk about. But it blew me away because this document does not get published through our Office of Communication. It does not get published by some marketing folks in our organization. It is published by the Financial Management Group. Again, the accountants. I don't know about you, but accountants generally aren't the most like, this is what's going on. But clearly, they got the message, right? There's 6,500 CMS employees, thousands of contractors, and I am so impressed that our financial department has got the message where this agency is going. We are transforming healthcare through competition and innovation. Even the accountants get it. That is really impressive. The other thing I really like, again, if you remember from last year when I talked a lot about e-Medicare, the adoption of technology, how we're bringing into the program, the flexibilities. And look at the cover. Again, this isn't the marketing department. This is the accountants. You see them looking at, you know, the iPhone. So the whole efforts that we've been undergoing the last couple of years are reflected in this cover report. And to me, it just said, like, the agency is getting it. Like, we are all getting on the same page, and we are going to drive. And I want to really build on that as we go forward. Not that I don't like Abe Lincoln. I do. But it's pretty impressive. So I'll start where I started last year, if I can get my slides to stop moving. Let's talk about the big challenges, right? What are the challenges facing the program? You can see that healthcare in the nation costs $3.5 trillion. Health insurance makes up 75% of that. And then if you pull it over to the right, you can see that CMS manages about 36%. Again, we are the largest payer in the world. This might strike you as very abstract. You know, I can go on to say that, you know, healthcare in the United States is about 18% of gross domestic product. That might not strike you. We're headed towards 19 in less than a decade. At least that's what the actuaries are predicting. And maybe a better way to bring this home is on a per capita basis. On a per capita basis, in the United States, we pay $10,000 to $11,000 per person. $10,000 to $11,000. Comparable other developed countries spend $6,000 or $5,000. So we pay almost double to our comparison countries. We have a cost problem. There's no doubt about it. And again, maybe that's abstract to you. $10,000 per person, more than double other developed countries. What does that mean to me, right? What does it mean to me and my staff back where I work? Well, I think this slide speaks to it. This slide is looking at cost of premiums. Okay? And you can see that premiums are increasing. What does the worker pay? What do you and I pay? If you get to 2019, on average, we spend, as an individual worker, $1,200 per person out of our pocket. The employer pays, obviously, a match. If you have a family of four, out of your pocket, you're spending approximately, on average, $6,000. I'm fortunate enough to have one extra kid, so I'm spending more than that, right? So this is very personal, and I'm sure it's personal to all of you as well. So when we think about transformation, we need to get all of our staff on board because it touches every single one of us. And maybe to bring this home a little bit more, over the past 5 years, premiums have increased 22%. Past 5 years, increased 22%. In the same period, wages went up 14% and inflation was 8%. Do you see a problem? Right? Is this personal? It's touching every one of you. Okay? So we got a problem, got a challenge, cost. I'm going to talk predominantly about Medicare. Okay? And I'm going to come back to this slide. When my kids were little, I'd like show them a picture like of a goat and a cow and be like, what doesn't look right? What looks different? What looks different between benefit payments on A, B, and D? Of course, on A, you don't see any orange, right? No orange. Orange is payment from the Treasury. That 88% that pays for Part A is a Medicare tax. If you've looked at your pay stub, which I'm sure you look at every other week, an average employee pays about 1.4% Medicare tax. Your employer pays about 3%. Don't raise your hand. Please don't raise your hand. I don't really want to know. I do want to thank you, though. If you make over $200,000 or as a couple $250,000, you pay about 2.4%. Thank you. We need the money. Okay? So thank you for the green. In the years that go by, right, the years that go by, really since the inception of the program up until somewhat recently, we collected more than we put out in benefit payments, and we built up a surplus. Probably everyone here knows in the past decade that has flipped. Okay? And I'll come back to that in a little bit. Just remember, part A, no orange. And again, thank you for those making a little bit more. This slide I don't want to get into. We'll kind of dice it and slice it a little bit. This is just showing you benefit payments over the past 10 years. You can see that A, I would point out if you look at A, in 2008, if I get my pointer to work here, maybe it doesn't really work. Oh, well, A is 50%. So 10 years ago, A was about 50% of our payments. 2 years after the inception of the Part D plans, we were spending $49 billion or 11%. Bring that up to last year, A went down. Yeah, A went down. That's a result of some policies that we've been working on for many years. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing, at least as a percentage. You can see B went up. And I'm going to come back to this at the very end of the conversation. Okay, at the very end of the conversation. So try to remember that Part D almost doubled in 10 years. So when you think about cost of prescription drugs, cost of the program, benefit payments, that's a real issue for us. Okay? This is, again, just another kind of breakout. It's really showing you just another kind of segmenting of our benefit payments here by year. You can see in 2018, still the $731 billion. 13% was D. Again, I'll come back to that. Now you get to see what C cost. Okay, C was 32% of our benefit payments last year. Some of you, including one of my interns at one point, said, well, that's really good, Greg, 32%, because now 35% of Medicare enrollees are in C. So that's really a good thing. No, it's not a bad thing per se, but it's not the complete story. You're not seeing everything here. The CMS Office of the Actuary did some analysis and found out that to run the fee-for-service program, right, that pays my salary and our colleagues in the room, to run the fee-for-service program is 1.4% of benefit payments. So 1.4 of 731 is what it costs to run fee-for-service. In the same study, the Office of the Actuary looked at not C, but D plans, and they found it cost 10.7%. That includes administration and profit. Okay, 10.7. And when I get to the innovation part of this discussion, you'll see we're thinking about different ways to address administrative costs. Okay, so just keep this in mind. This is just another kind of looking now more specifically at services in the Medicare program. You can see in 2009, 23% was managed care. That has gone up to 32%, as you saw in the previous slides. No surprise. Again, we're up to a 35% enrollment. What's maybe more notable is you can see inpatient hospital has decreased. Outpatient hospital has gone up. We've done a lot with something we refer to as site neutrality. The beneficiary can go to a physician practice, to an outpatient practice, different sites, and we are working so where they're paying the same. Okay. So some of this is a result of the work that we've been doing. Again, we will come back to Part D, going up to 13%, and then we'll talk a little bit about, just briefly, about what we're doing in Part B in fee-for-service to drive costs down and improve quality. Okay? So just getting you some background. So as I mentioned, I love the CFO report. It's only 3 weeks old. It's fun. It's really interesting, actually. You can see 2018 on the left. We spent just under $1 trillion at CMS. Our colleagues over at Social Security were over $1 trillion. If you were to subtract the two, pulled out your iPhone and subtract the two, it's $45 billion between CMS and Social Security. Then you go to 2019, you can see we've gone up $85 billion. to over a trillion. Social Security also went up. If you were to pull out your calculator and do the subtraction between the two sister federal agencies, the difference between the two is $21 billion. Okay? I'm going to come back to that. There's something going on there. This is just showing you the percentage change from last year's report to this year's report. No surprise with the enrollment that I'll talk about in a second. Medicare has gone up. Don't misread into the Medicaid going down to 16%. Medicaid is still either the first or second state budget line item, and their costs are going up. And in fact, it looks like it may double in 10 years. So the states also have some significant challenges, as we do at the federal level. Again, things you likely already well know. So that's a cost. I'll kind of stop talking about cost, although I'll touch just briefly back on it. This is from the trustees report last spring, showing enrollment. I apologize for those folks way in the back. This is not the best slide, but again, I'm working with the accountants, so this is what you get. You get a good cover, but some of the tables aren't so good for public display. Anyhow, at the end of last year when I was here, we were just under 60 million Medicare beneficiaries. We're going to end this year at about 61 million. I've highlighted 2026, which will be about 74 million. And by 2030, 10 years from now, we'll be at almost 80 million beneficiaries. Yeah, right? Some people are like, wow. That's right. It's a third of what we have today and adding it on top. And I won't be able to have time. Some of my CMS colleagues will appreciate this. We have an initiative at CMS called Modernizing CMS. As like many of you, we're adding a third, right? That's a lot. We are thinking about the systems we need. We're thinking about the staff we need. We're thinking about the structure we need, because we have a lot of change going on at CMS. And not only is it the enrollment piece, the number of people we're going to care for, it's the systems, it's the approach. I will shift, eventually into our strategy. We need different types of staff than we've needed before. So there's a lot of change. And if you think about I heard Catherine talking about call centers. The 1-800 call center is one of our most expensive contracts at CMS. We, too, try to have response times when you call in. When you add another third, you need more operators. That's more cost to us. That's more cost to the program. So there's a lot to think about. If you, as an organization, haven't been looking at these trends and thinking forward, you definitely need to. We are, no doubt about it. So this slide is getting at the point that a small percentage of Medicare beneficiaries, both in fee-for-service and MA, take up the greatest part of our benefit payments, right? So the purple, 17%, have six or more chronic conditions. Six or more chronic conditions, about 17% of the population, and they consume 53% of that $800 billion, right? So it's a small group that takes the most. And we think a lot about this. Because when beneficiaries generally come in, they don't have six or more chronic conditions. So over the time that they're in the program, they end up that way and then start to eat up a significant portion of the payments. And the point being is we need to transition away from a program that pays for episodes of sickness, right? You only go to the doctor when you're sick. So when I get to the innovations part, you'll see we're mandating certain elements of wellness and prevention because we need to address this. And you'll also see in the models that we're thinking a lot about how to do care coordination, make sure we've got primary care access, medical homes, because we need to be able to identify risk factors and then control them for the length of the time that we have the beneficiary in our program. So this slide is very important. It tells us many, many things beyond just a cost piece. So I did say I wouldn't come back to cost, but I will for a minute. And what I'm going to try to make a point about is not that the Part A Trust Fund is going to be insolvent. It's more that a window will open, as windows have in the past. So for those like me who've been around for a while, you probably remember the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003. That was a significant change to CMS. And then the Affordable Care Act came in 2010. That was another considerable change. And the point I'm trying to make is every time there's a window in health policy at Congress, you get a lot of things in that maybe you didn't anticipate or that you knew about, but you didn't think they'd make it into the program maybe so quickly. And the point that I'm really trying to make with this slide is not that, because you know this, right? The Part A Trust Fund will become insolvent in less than 7 years. And the CFO report validated that. So the trustees report, where I took this from in the spring, said that. And the CFO report validated it. We've got less than 7 years till the Part A Trust Fund. If I did a straight line calculation, probably around October 2026, we won't be able to make payments, all of our payments on Part A. Do I really think that's going to happen? Right? The last slide said we'll have 74 million beneficiaries in Medicare, and Part A won't be able to pay its bills in less than 7 years. Do you really think that is going to happen? No, I really don't. I mean, can I guarantee you? No, I would never take that bet. I'd probably lose. I do have two kids in college. But the reality is, it is significantly likely that Congress will open the door here at some point to make some changes. I made light of paying Medicare tax, right? The 1.3 and the 2.4. Again, thank you for those who pay more. We appreciate that. I make light of that, but it gets harder every year because the number of workers is decreasing and the number of beneficiaries is increasing. You can't just tweak the tax rate. It gets harder, okay? But the window is going to open sometime in the next 6 years. And the question really is, as I talk about innovation, what are those models that are going to come in? Okay? I'll give you an example. I don't know how much you know about fee-for-service, okay? So bear with me. In 2003, we were overpaying for durable medical equipment. Grossly overpaying. If you probably saw some headlines, you could go to Walmart and pay $20, but we would pay several hundred, right? There was some truth to those headlines. So in 2003, or actually early 2000, we did something in Florida and a couple states called competitive bidding. You're probably familiar with the concept. That model proved pretty successful in getting how we could pay for durable medical equipment. Okay, it was only in three areas, three states, three counties. Wasn't a huge program. Did show very promising. When the window opened in 2003, guess what made its way in? Competitive bidding. Okay? Another example that we're going to talk about is in the fee-for-service program, shared savings. There had been some corporate work on shared savings. We had done one demonstration on shared savings. Affordable Care Act came. Guess what entered into the program? Shared savings. So the question I would have for you today, in the models that I present, in the models that you're working on and supporting our programs, which of those is going to get in when this window opens? I don't know. But it's going to happen. The window's going to happen, and there are going to be changes to the program. That's really what I'm trying to get at. I don't think we'll become insolvent, but it will happen. We will do something. So before I get into innovation or strategy, before I move to strategy, I think it's really helpful to look at the program from the beneficiary's point of view, right? The patient's at the center. Patient's at the center. So in 2016... 50%, one in two, of our beneficiaries made $26,000 or less. Okay? You could also say they made more. Cup half empty, kept it full. But the federal poverty limit, if you remember, $12,000. So there's a lot of room above where Medicaid eligibility is until you get to the $26,000. Okay? Why is that important? Oh. Let's see if I can go back. Let's see if it stays. Okay, why is that important? Thinking about it from the beneficiary's point of view. This slide is showing you what their average total out-of-pocket spending is. So again, that one in two makes $26,000, and they spend $5,400. If you got your phone out and you divide, that's 20%. 20% of their income is going towards health care. This gets back to this is a personal situation. This is hard. Many of you probably work with your parents and loved ones. You get it, right? This is hard. We got a cost problem. You can also kind of see how it breaks out. Prescription drugs continues to increase. And maybe just to bring this home, let's have a little fun for just a minute. Who here knows what the Part B premium is right now in 2019? What do beneficiaries either pay or get pulled from their Social Security benefit every month for Part B on average? I heard it. 135. Excellent. Excellent work. $135 a month. Do you happen to know? Here's the question. What's it going up to in a month? I heard it over here. Somebody wanted to shout it out. $144.60. You're so close. You still deserve a prize. But I have children in college and I can't give you anything. So correct, it's going up $9. $9. Does anybody know what the largest part of that $9 is? This is fee for service, not C. What contributed to the biggest part of that $9 increase? Anybody know? Yes, physician-administered drugs. Again, I'd give you a prize, but I can't. That is correct. Physician-administered drugs. Are drugs a problem for us at CMS? Yes, they are. Okay, and we'll talk about a model that's addressing them. One last question. So again, it's going up by 7%. It is automatically pulled from their benefit. They don't get a choice. We pull it out. I don't. Our accountants do. Please blame them. We pull it out. They never write a check for it. It comes out of their benefit. What is Social Security going up to next year? What is the cost of living adjustment for beneficiaries next year? Not one person knows. 1.6%. Part B, I didn't talk about the deductible. I'm just talking about premium. It's going up 7%. Their Social Security checks are going up by 1.6%. It's personal, right? We all have to find a way to innovate and drive sustainability, okay? Because we're all headed that way, right? We all are. So let's talk strategy, right? And I really wanted to kind of give you a glimpse of, like, what is the most recent work, the strategy that our senior leaders in the executive branch and our administrator are looking to address the problems I've talked about. So I thought it fitting to take a look at this new executive order. Came out October 3rd, titled Protecting and Improving Medicare for Our Nation's Seniors. I've encouraged my leaders to read this because it's right about our program. And I think I would encourage you and your staff to read it. If you take it out of the text, pop it into a Word document, change it to 12-point font, it's 4 pages, okay? And there's, you know, I've read a number of articles about it. There's a lot in there to think about. And it will drive the work you heard Catherine talk about. It will drive our regulations on fee-for-service. I would encourage you to take a look. You know, what's in there? I don't have time to talk through all of it. It talks about options for Medicare Advantage. You heard Catherine talking about reducing burden. We're not just doing that on MA. We're doing it across the program. The idea, when you go back to transforming with competition and innovation, we want the market to run efficiently. So we have to reduce the burden, get the obstacles out of the market. And so we're very much focused on reducing burden, changing our payment paradigms so that clinicians can have more time with patients. We can have more access and capacity to clinicians, want to adopt medical technologies, fraud, waste, and abuse, you know, and then empower beneficiaries or their caregivers. I do want to just read this. I apologize. I try not to read things, but this is Section 2. I will read Section 2 of this executive order in its entirety because I think it really builds on the next couple slides. It is the policy of the United States to protect and improve the Medicare program. So if you've been sleeping till now, listen to this. By enhancing its fiscal sustainability, like that makes sense, right? I just spent some time, yep. Enhancing its fiscal sustainability through alternative payment methodologies that link payment to value, increase choice, and lower regulatory burdens imposed upon providers. Okay, so alternative payment methodologies. Keep that in mind as I keep going. So that's the executive order. If you read page 1 and 2 of the CMS financial report, I'm hoping I can sell some copies of this today. You will see our administrator has three strategic goals. Empowering patients, so doing things like price transparency, doing things like e-Medicare, get the information out where beneficiaries and their caregivers can use it, like Amazon, to make informed choices. That will, in an efficient market, that will drive competition and select those entities that have the best quality at the lowest cost. So empowering patients. Two, focus on results. This goes to this alternate payment methodology. Stop paying on volume. Stop just randomly, you know, paying a claim. Pay for value. Pay for outcomes. Pay for quality, right? Pay for those things, population health. And then lastly, unleash innovation. I was back in the green room with Ann chatting, but I was listening to Catherine. You can see a lot of this idea of unleashing innovation. It's already starting to come into the MA side. And you'll see in some of these models, we're doing more and more to encourage MA plans, providers, entities to innovate. We're giving them waiver authority. We're giving them the opportunity to really do rapid cycle innovation. So these are the three goals that the administrator published just 3 weeks ago. And I'm sure my colleagues at CMS have seen this many times. This is the wheel, if I can get back to it. Maybe I can't get back to it. There you go. That's the wheel. Some people have like giant posters of this thing. But if you look at the outside of the wheel, you'll see those three strategic goals, right? Powering patients, paying for value, and unleashing innovation. And then there's broad objectives and then specific strategic objectives with the beneficiary or patient in the middle. I do not have time to go through all 16 today. We're going to talk about strengthening Medicare and innovation. But I will tell you this, when you think back to that cover memo from our CFO report, all of the leaders at the agency have like lived this thing. We are coalescing around it and we are driving towards it. There is no doubt about that. So if you're not convinced by the CFO report, please believe me, we're driving towards these objectives. Man, I just can't get this to go. So let's transition now to what we're doing. What's our strategy? Like, what are we doing to innovate? And as the top of the slide says here, you know, we're working towards a patient-centered, market-driven reform that gets us away from where we've been, producer-centered, so that's provider-centered, you know, paying claims. The more claims you submit, the more you get paid, unsustainable, the cost concerns, and fragmented care, which I've talked about. We want to get away from that and move over to patient-centered, paying for value or outcomes, sustainable, market-driven, and coordinated care. That's where we want to go. And I just want it to go forward. Oh, there it goes. So I want to just share with you a couple minutes about two large value-based program, alternate payment methodologies that we're doing in fee-for-service, okay? And then I'll talk more specifically about some of the work we're doing in the Innovation Center. So the Shared Savings Program. First, let me just start with what is it, okay? That's actually the second bullet point is getting to the what is an ACO, if you don't know already, is that it's groups of doctors and hospitals and other providers coming together to care for attributed or assigned beneficiaries, okay? And they come together, and then they are evaluated on quality, cost, and experience of care. And if they can reduce costs below a benchmark, and this is where the word shared savings comes in, they share savings with CMS. They don't get to keep all the savings. They keep some, we keep some, okay? So that's very quickly, in a nutshell, what it is. There's, as you know, we would, there's a lot of rules around how you participate, how you apply, the size, the network, all those things. But know that that's what it is. Now, I think it's important to talk a minute, like, where did this come from, right? I've already kind of alluded to it. So prior to 2010, we had done one demonstration. Some of your parent companies had actually driven ACOs, shown some promise. And when the Affordable Care Act went through, wouldn't you know it, the fee-for-service program or Medicare now had an ACO shared savings program. So that started in 2012 with just like four of them. And I'll show you some results in just a minute. And then we started to see in 5 to 6 years that most of these ACOs weren't taking on a lot of risk. We created an opportunity where they could get significant upside risk, but then they had some down. Most of the ACOs said, you know, I don't need that great opportunity. I'm going to stick a little bit here and just keep the upside risk. I don't want to expose myself to downside risk. They weren't taking the big leap. And so what we did in 2018, just a year ago, we issued what we refer to in the rule as pathways to success. We basically now will put every accountable care organization on a pathway where they have two-sided risk. You cannot stay in this program anymore just on an upside. You can start that way, but you will end up, if you stay in our program, in two-sided risk, really giving them a greater incentive to innovate, you know, unleash innovation, and find ways to pay for value. We've seen, as this slide says, we've already seen that jump from a very small percentage to 29% of the ACOs, and we expect that to potentially double next year. The other thing, when you think about unleashing innovation, that you heard Catherine talk about, and I'll talk about some of our models, is that we're giving them, the more risk they take on, the more tools we're giving them. One of which is waiving this three-day SNF waiver. So if they're in a high-risk situation, we want to give them a tool to control costs, and they can waive the three-day inpatient requirement to get access to the skilled nursing facility benefit. That's one example. Also in this rule, and Catherine talked about it on the MA side, we're giving them greater ability to use telehealth. There's more flexibility in the MA side with telehealth than there is in fee-for-service. But if you go into an ACO, we're giving you a lot more flexibility to use telehealth to engage with fee-for-service beneficiaries and support them. And then lastly, something that's very new for fee-for-service, it's not on the slide, is we're giving them the opportunity to do beneficiary incentives and rewards. Okay? So we'll see. This will be the first year where beneficiary incentives and rewards can be offered in the ACO program in calendar year 2020. So again, we're giving them the tools to unleash innovation. How has it gone? There you go. So this slide is looking at the total number of covered beneficiaries. Like I mentioned, the program didn't even start until 2012 with just a very few number of ACOs. And you can see by the end of this year, we're at 2019 at 10.9. That is 27% of the fee-for-service population is now in an ACO. It's pretty good. Pretty good. But getting people in is just part of it. What about cash performance, right? Cost performance. You can see by the end of this of last year, just under $1 billion. Remember, these are shared savings. What you're seeing are the payments going to the ACOs. There's also money being returned to the trust fund. Okay? So we're very pleased with where we have been thus far in 6 years, 6 or 7 years. We believe that CMS, on our shared savings portion, we expect that we're on track to return to the trust fund in the next decade another $3 billion. Okay? Doesn't sound huge, but you have to also appreciate there are our quality and interoperability requirements, and so we're bringing the healthcare system along and generating savings at better quality. So we're very pleased with that. So let me talk a little bit about another fee-for-service program that ties value to payment and give you an update. Okay? This slide should have said the quality payment program. I wasn't paying close attention, so it says MACRA. I was like, dang it. But what can you do? MACRA is actually what gave us the quality payment program. The Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act of 2015 looked at Part B as employee payment. So those providers, physicians and the like, who bill the physician fee schedule, right, really didn't have any skin in the game. And the sustained growth rate factor wasn't working. You probably remember all of that. And so what MACRA did is say, we're going to start to tie Part B, fee-for-service provider payments, to value, okay? And in that program started in 2017. And I'll just try to very briefly summarize what that did. The quality payment program evaluates those eligible Part B providers for four attributes: cost, quality, improvement, and interoperability. Okay? You get evaluated. There are some reporting requirements. Then you get a score. If you don't get above a certain benchmark, we actually take money off of your claims. If you're above the benchmark, you get additional funds on top of the claims that you submitted in that performance year. So how did it go, right? How did this program go? In the first year, 95% of eligible clinicians or providers in the quality payment program avoided a downward adjustment, and 93% got a positive adjustment. In the second year, that went up to 98 and 95. So we're very pleased to see how that is going. We are taking small steps, but it is a huge effort to move something that was tied to volume to value, and we're seeing a lot of positive progress. And you probably, if you're reading this slide, you're like, well, that's great, Greg, but what does this have to do with the slide you're showing me? This slide is really talking about alternative payment models, APMs, alternative payment models. To maximize your revenue in the quality payment program, the goal is not to be successful at MIPS. You certainly would like to be. You don't want a downward adjustment. But to maximize your performance, you would like to be in an alternative payment model. Okay, this is where you maximize the greatest revenue as a provider, which means CMS needs to provide those opportunities as well as many of your MA plans. I looked last year when I spoke. I can't remember. It was like a handful of MA plans that were offering qualified APMs. I looked again last week. Now there are 5 parent companies who have approved APMs in the quality payment program, and that worked out to like 45 different separate plans. 5 parents, 45 plans. So that's a very positive sign because we want to do this in a multi-payer strategy to support the transformation. So let's use that to talk about innovation. This slide is showing you blue dots and orange squares. And the blue squares show you where sites of APMs are being offered. The orange squares are where states are working with us to offer alternative payment opportunities. The goal of this slide is to make blue and orange cover the map, right? That's the goal. How have we done so far? Under the quality payment program, to maximize revenue in an APM, you have to be a qualified participant, which means you have to have a certain number of people in a model. You've got to be in a model, blah, blah, blah. Year one, we had 99,000 providers who were qualified participants in an APM. In year two, we doubled that number, went to 198,000 providers. And we're trying to do that again. And seriously, thank you for the MA plans out there who are making these opportunities for them. And we are launching more and more models because that's what will cause the transformation. Alternative payment strategy around paying for value. So again, that's our goal, blue and orange. So let's look at some of the models, okay? So here are some models. I'll talk about 3 fee-for-service models coming out of the Innovation Center, and then I'll talk about 3 Medicare Advantage models. Yeah, I think I got 15 more minutes. So the first one is the primary care first. And as I review these, I'm going to talk to you about what is the issue that we're trying to solve for, what's the intervention or the how, and then what are we trying to achieve? Right? That's important when you think about transformation. So the first large fee-for-service model is primary care first. This builds on models that we've been doing in primary care for almost a decade, actually, with the Innovation Center now. And what it's really trying to do is that we recognize that an efficient U.S. healthcare system needs primary care. Right? You need to have that medical home, as it were. You need to have capacity and access to primary care, so that you can identify risk factors, you can manage chronic disease at the lowest level, that they have a point to go to care or coordinate care and really assist them through this healthcare paradigm that we have. So this model, what is it trying to solve? It's trying to maintain what we have, grow it, give it the flexibility to add technology, and create that capacity. How are we doing? What's the intervention? And some of that is on the slide here. We're trying to simplify the payment methodology for primary care and move it to a population type of payment based on value so that it's simple, it's predictable, and reliable. You don't need beneficiaries to keep coming into your office to drive your revenue, right? If you're getting paid a population health, you can interact with them through technology, through the phone, because you're being paid for the population that you oversee, not an individual beneficiary by beneficiary. So simple, predictable, and reliable, a population primary care payment. We're also looking at a flat fee, right? So when the beneficiary comes in, they pay one single flat fee. I mean, if you know Part B, it's a 20% cost share. You got your gap in there. I mean, it's hard sometimes to figure out when they ask what to pay. We're making it simple, reducing burden, right? And then lastly in this model, a significant upside, significant, 50%. 10% down, 50% up as a true incentive to move them through this model. And what are we trying to achieve? Reduce Medicare spending by preventing avoidable inpatient hospital admissions, right? Get them to that primary care practice. Treat them at the lowest level. Improve the quality and care they receive. And that's number two. So that is primary care first. Oops. Number two is direct contracting. You know, I talked a little bit about administration and cost. I've also talked about ACOs. The way I think about direct contracting, this is kind of a complex model. You've got to spend some time thinking about it. I think about this model in the most simplistic terms as like an alternative ACO, right? Even waive the rules around ACOs. Let a direct contracting entity come into CMS. They will identify their providers and support they need to manage their population. We contract with a direct contracting entity that, again, may not necessarily have to be an ACO or the rules that sit on top of that. And then they effectuate payment to the providers in their space, their regional space, with these different options, with significant risk, right? And as it says, you know, that's really the goal, is to change the contracting paradigm to create these flexibilities so that ultimately we reach a place in direct contracting where you've changed the risk-sharing arrangement in fee-for-service Medicare, right? Now, instead of necessarily contracting with an ACO, you're contracting with an alternative type of entity that manages their care and their network, as it were. Empower beneficiaries to engage. The idea is we're working with an entity that knows their population best. And then reduce provider burden. In this model, providers will still submit claims, but payment doesn't come from CMS or the MAC. It comes from the direct contracting entity. So there's a lot of flexibility about how that is done. So again, transforming risk sharing, reducing burden, moving towards payment for value and quality. The last fee-for-service model I just want to share with you is a representative of the things that we're doing and how we're deploying the administrator's strategy is the emergency triage, treat, and transport, or we refer to it as the agency because we love acronyms, as ET3. So what is ET3 trying to solve for? What's the issue for this model? If you know fee-for-service policy, we only pay emergency ground ambulances when they pick somebody up and they take them to a hospital, a critical access hospital, a SNF. So I think you get it. There is a clear incentive to the ground ambulance company to get that person, pick them up, and take them somewhere. They may not need it, but once they dispatch it, it is a clear incentive to move that somewhere so they can get paid. So we want to look at that differently. We want to try something new. We want to adjust that incentive that could be driving our costs and may work contrary to the beneficiary's interest, right? So what is the how or what is the intervention in this model? So what will happen is the beneficiary, their caregiver, or loved one will call 911. We're looking at working with local and state governments. You'll call 911. The operator will do what they do now. But if they can look at that and say, you know, maybe you don't need an ambulance, they will refer it to a medical triage line. So a nurse practitioner, who will try to work with the beneficiary at that level, maybe even connect them to the primary care practice. So maybe we don't need to dispatch it. But ultimately, if the beneficiary wants it or needs it, then that ambulance would be dispatched. And if you look at the slide, you can see there are options then once it gets dispatched to address this maybe perverse incentive. So once the ambulance shows up, maybe they can treat on scene if that's allowed under their scope of practice, right? So maybe they can treat right on the scene. Maybe they can take the beneficiary to their primary care practice if it's available and open, right? And they will receive payment for that. And then lastly, if they need to, they'll go to the hospital as they would today. So you can kind of see we're really thinking through. We have a rule that says this and drives these incentives. How can we turn that upside down, work with our state and local partners, reduce some of these addendums, really help the beneficiary, right? Empower the beneficiary, drive better quality of care, and also drive lower costs. So I really like this model. It's really an interesting model. So now we'll transition over to Medicare Advantage. This is the value-based insurance design. I have to say it was interesting to listen to Catherine. Some of these things have already started to come into your program. These are still going on. You can see that last year we expanded up to 25 states. And, you know, what's the issue? What are we trying to solve for in this model with Medicare Advantage plans, you all, and the work that you do? It's really quite simply about allowing you the flexibility to do what you do already quite well better, right? Give you some of that waiver authority, give you the flexibility to try new things, unleash innovation, and see what works, okay? So what's the intervention? Oh, wow. I know, right? I can't control it. Here are the interventions. And Catherine spoke to some of these, so it sounds like some of this has already come into the main program. But you can target either reduced cost sharing or additional supplement benefits either on chronic conditions. So when the model launched, there were 7 chronic conditions, diabetes, congestive heart failure, so on and so forth. We added 2 more in 2018, rheumatoid arthritis and dementia. So a total of 9 different chronic conditions that you can target and then apply supplemental benefits. And it was interesting to hear Catherine say that's a big change for MA. Okay, we're still piloting that in this model, as well as social economic status. Can you, and or a combination of A and B? That's the intervention there. Again, like ACOs, giving you the authority to do rewards and incentives, okay? And expanding the authority to do telehealth. Don't ask me if it's much different than what has just come into the MA program. I don't know. But I know there is considerable flexibility in a CMS model because the statute gives us that flexibility. But anyway, also the opportunity to really engage with telehealth. And then lastly, go back to that slide when you think about 6 or more chronic conditions, and it says required for participation, wellness and healthcare planning, an effort to get away from episodes of sickness. We've got to care for this beneficiary from the time they enter the program until they leave the program. And we need to find a way to leverage wellness and healthcare planning to do that. And so we're doing that in this model with your assistance. You should also know that in 2021, we'll be also looking at adding a hospice benefit option to this model in those 25 states. So what is the issue here, right? You probably all know this very well. In the MA program, once the beneficiary elects hospice, they leave MA, right? The illness unrelated to hospice is fee-for-service. And to make it even more complex, the Part D benefit generally stays with the MA plan. So you went from a beneficiary who is very comfortable working with their MA plan to now being in a hospice benefit, fee-for-service, and a Part D plan. Does that sound fragmented to you? Yeah, a little bit. It does, a little bit. So that's the issue, is if we allow the MA plan to contract in their benefit design, can that improve quality, care, coordination, and cost? It seems obvious that it would. I will tell you, we've done a number of demonstrations over the years at CMS and other models, including models in fee-for-service. Hospice is a tricky thing, tricky. We have had so success with trying to drive improvement on hospice. So if you think we're taking it slow, that is intentional. We want to see how this goes. We have tried to jump into these things a little bit more aggressively in the past and not had the best outcome. So now we're going to be working with you to try this approach. Quite clearly, the goals then are to improve quality, care, and cost through VBID. So I've gotten to the very last model. 3 minutes to go. Thank goodness Catherine gave me some time. So I will be very quick. The Part D model, right? So what's the issue? If you go back to the very beginning, I told you in 10 years, we've almost doubled the cost of the Part D program. Now, it's sustainable. Why is it sustainable? Because of the orange. Orange is general treasury. It is not going to be insolvent, but it's going to drive a lot of cost. And the issue we're really trying to get at this program not only is cost, but it's how the Part D plan is structured, right? You move through the Part D benefit based on list price. So even though there's pricing negotiation going on behind the scenes, it is the list price of the drug that drives the beneficiary from deductible to catastrophic coverage and donut hole, like right through the thing, is the list price. And with the specialty tier and some brand name drugs, we have seen a 14% increase in beneficiaries who have accelerated through the benefit in the same 10 years. And really, for a Part D plan, and you all know this better than I do, that means your ability to apply incentives decreases as they move through the benefit, especially once they end up in catastrophic coverage. Right? Because now they're left with small copays. So you as a Part D plan have lost your ability to manage these people effectively. And so that's the issue that we're trying to get in the Part D model, is let's look at another way of structuring this, modifying risk sharing, and see if we can apply incentives to continue to improve the cost and quality of the beneficiary. How are we going to do that? Very much like this slide points out, which is, as you've heard before, applying rewards and incentives, readdressing the structure, applying more disease state management, medication therapy, and looking to see if that improves quality, outcomes, and cost, and see if we can drive down some of that increasing cost of the Part D program. That takes me to my very last slide. Whew, that's a lot, right? That is a lot. And that is a small segment of all the things we're doing at CMS. Small. We are focused again on empowering patients, paying for value, unleashing innovation. I have many more examples, so do my colleagues, so please talk to us about how we're doing this. And you have to ask at the end of this, is it working? Are we making a difference? Is the work you're doing with us making a difference? The answer to that is yes. This slide is showing we're starting to reduce the cost growth. Still got a lot of work to go, but we are seeing some impact. The Office of Inspector General took a critical review last summer of the Medicare Shared Savings Program and determined that that, too, is driving better outcomes and lower costs. So we are seeing positive impact. I want to just tell you a story in a minute or less. I promise I won't be long-winded. Last Friday, I went to a holiday party. I have no idea how I ended up in Wisconsin in this really swanky Christmas party. I don't know how I got there. Let's just say everybody there was paying 2.4% of their, like, Medicare tax when they were working, and I wasn't. So I was like, who are these people? How did I get here? And I ended up at a table not far from the host, so I wasn't in the back, but, you know, and everybody at the table except for my wife and I were 70 years old. They also had two or three martinis on board. They were having a good time. I never tell people what I do for a living. Never. Especially in that setting, because you'll never get out, right? So the host comes over halfway through, and probably an extra martini for the people at the table, all eight of them, and said, oh, this is Greg. He works on Medicare. And I thought, oh, no, don't do that. Sure enough, Gail, sitting right next to me, launches into a conversation about her MA plan and how the dental coverage isn't robust enough. And again, she's got a couple martinis on board there. And I tried to explain to her in layman's terms about supplemental benefits and, you know, the statutory restrictions on dental care. And, you know, and I could feel my wife's arm slowly coming to grab me. But Gail turns to me and says, we got to make it better because I got this cap and it cost me all this money. And I just thought, I didn't know what to say because that by that time my wife grabbed me. And I just thought, yeah, you know, we'll do that, Gail. Yeah. But I think about that and I think, you know, Gail's right. Like, it's incumbent on all of us to make it better. And that's what I tell my staff. Like, look at what you're doing. We're making this huge investment in improvement and lean and things. Like, we've got to make it better. So I would just think about Gail, two or three martinis to the wind as I leave. And how can you make it better? How can you help us continue to improve? Got a lot ahead of us, and it's personal. With that, I'll say thank you. I think I'm over time.